Very happy to be connected to Lynn Alden right now. Hi, Lynn.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Was Bitcoin Bringt. Thanks for being on the German podcast. For once, we're doing this in English, of course, but we will add subtitles. And you just told me that you have connections to Germany.
Prior connections, yeah. My father's side of my family is originally from Germany, the Black Forest region. It was even that naming aspect was even in part of our surname for a while, the family's surname, the Schwarzwald.
Oh, really?
I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, but that was part of the family name.
So did you ever go back on a heritage excursion?
I plan on it, but it's not something I've been able to do yet. I've been to Germany as like flying through, but I haven't been able to give the time that it deserves.
Well, I hope you'll get a chance because your book Broken Money is coming out at Apricot Media. It's one of the most important launches of the year. It's coming out on December 6, 2024. And the German Bitcoin community is trying to push it to a Spiegel bestseller, which is the name of a famous magazine that does the bestseller list. So I will have the Amazon link in there. There's also the possibility if you buy at least 10 of the books, you get a chance to even get a premium subscription to your newsletter. Thank you very much for that. And of course, your book Broken Money is, I mean, let's maybe the most important book after the Bitcoin Standard for Bitcoin. It doesn't have Bitcoin in the title. Do you think that's good or bad for books sold?
I think it's hard to say. I think it's different. It is, at least in the English version, it's one of the better selling books that covers Bitcoin positively. That is kind of written by someone with a very pro Bitcoin perspective. Obviously, it's not gonna sell to the likes of the Bitcoin Standard. That's the GOAT of the space. But it was really well selling in the English market, really well received. And I think it's, you know, there's so many books out there with Bitcoin in the title, where someone is seeking to learn about Bitcoin. And they find this Bitcoin book of you know, whether it's one of the short ones, whether it's one of the longer, more thorough ones. And I wanted to do an approach where we build up to Bitcoin. We get to Bitcoin in the third act, mm-hmm. really. And the first two acts, the first two thirds of the book are discussing how did we get here in the first place? What was the whole kind of history of technology and money? Because I think a lot of people don't have the association that money is kind of ultimately a technology, that at the very least technology greatly shifts how we interact with money, you know, what commodities can hold their scarcity versus others based on our human technology, or what are our various ways that we have technology to move around and manage ownership of money and different ledger systems. And so by the time that the reader gets to the Bitcoin section, they at this point in the book, they firmly know that technology and the changing of technology has been so instrumental in how we've changed our money in the past. So it tries to kind of ease the reader into it. And of course, there's already a really big Bitcoin audience that'll read the book. And then they get a lot, I think, out of the first two thirds that they might not otherwise get in other Bitcoin books.
And I think it's very important because Bitcoin is an option, right? Bitcoin is something that I can choose to use, choose to save my money in. But the other system, the broken system, like you write, is the one that everybody is in.
Exactly. It's the biggest incumbent system. And it's funny when people talk about, you know, Bitcoin's complex, people will never understand it. It's like, well, you should see how complex the fiat system is at its core. And people use it without understanding it. And that's, if anything, that's one of the downsides. It's why they're able to be on the wrong side of some of the things that go against them, whether it's debasement, whether it's censorship. There's not a lot of widespread understanding about how the system works. I think it's partially by design. And so the emphasis of the book is walking through the history of how we got here and then how does the current system work? Because that I think gives the context for why Bitcoin's relevant. People always ask, you know, what does Bitcoin solve or, you know, what does it do? And it's like, well, to answer that question, partially you have to see the contrast. You know, what is not Bitcoin like, so mm-hmm. that we can see what Bitcoin is useful for.
I do this sometimes when people tell me, you know, they don't want to hold Bitcoin because they don't understand it. Then I tell them, well, do you have a savings account? And then they say, of course. Then I say, please explain to me how the euro works, right? And nobody can because nobody ever, you know, touches that subject in school or even in real life. Do you like what is your story? Did you like see the system before you saw Bitcoin, or was Bitcoin like the vantage point that you needed?
I studied the system before Bitcoin, kind of more from a gold perspective. It's not an uncommon route. For whatever reason, when I was a little kid, I already, like, literally I was saving it. I was a coin collector. So I started out collecting foreign coins, like inexpensive coins from different countries. I just found them neat as a kid and I would collect them. Then I shifted more into like silver and gold coins. So like for like Christmas presents, for example, my father would give me like these like proof sets of like the latest, silver, coins mostly. And then like sometimes little like 1/2 ounce gold, you know, we weren't like super wealthy. So we weren't like, wasn't stacking too much gold, but mostly silver, tiny bit of gold, especially back then. This was like the '90s. So it was like way cheaper than it is now. That was a pretty significant bear market for precious metals. And so I was a collector, and I, you know, as a kid, I could tell you what inflation is, you know, maybe not the way I can do it now, but I was like, well, like they're going to keep making more dollars. And whereas silver and gold is like harder. So I kind of viewed it as savings as like my first investment in a way before I shifted more toward equities. So for whatever reason, it just became a subject that, there was never really a moment where I became aware. It's like I just kind of grew up increasingly aware and increasingly interested in investing and studying the current system.
So it was very, very, very similar for me. I also started with gold. I actually stuck with gold for too long. Did you sell your gold, or are you still investing in gold?
I still own gold. I have it in portfolios. It's a useful diversifier. I kind of put it there in place of bonds. You know, if I want something lower volatility that can just stay there. I also think there's something to be said about having just like physical analog money in reach, like, you know, bearer instrument money that's outside of the banking system. But I mean, obviously, like, Bitcoin has appreciated much more than gold. It certainly eclipsed any sort of size of my gold holdings. And there's more to say about Bitcoin than gold. So while I cover gold positively generally, I'm generally just much more of my attention is focused on Bitcoin.
I have to say, it really sounds is funny, but you basically sound like every German gold bug turned Bitcoiner. It's just that you speak English.
I mean, I like you said before we started, a lot of English speaking gold bugs or hard money types kind of came from Germany or have roots in Germany.
It's true. I mean, ask Peter Schiff where his family is from, right?
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
I mean, he's not big on Bitcoin, but I think he's just using it to market, to keep himself in the conversation. I don't know if you watch the news these days. So I had a whole list of topics I wanted to talk to you about. But I think with the whole Trump situation and the all-time highs that we are now racing from one all-time high to another, my questions can come later or not at all. Lynn, like, what are you looking at right now? What is going through your mind with regards to the Bitcoin price and the political situation in the U.S.?
So yeah, that's a very broad question. For people that don't know, I publish research, both like open research and then like a research service. And so I cover macro, I cover different asset classes, and I cover updates on Bitcoin. And so of course the election has outcomes for a number of these things. I think in the U.S. And probably elsewhere, but in the U.S., a lot of investors, I think, maybe focus a little bit too much on politics. They kind of assume that the president can control everything, whereas it's just one big piece among many others. But obviously, elections have outcomes, and so I'm monitoring right now some of the fiscal implications that it could have. Touching on the other aspects are generally outside of my focus because I focus on investment. So it's mainly the numbers that are relevant. So from a macro perspective, it's what are the likely spending or taxation changes that they're not going to do or that they're going to do? So for example, there are certain tax cuts that were done in Trump's prior term that are set to automatically expire. A Trump victory with a red sweep probably increases the odds that those get renewed, or at least mostly renewed. We have to see what happens with tariffs. That's kind of a big unknown right now is to what extent they're going to be implemented versus just used as a negotiating tactic. And any sort of other legislation they might do that impacts the fiscal aspect. I generally am in the camp that the U.S. is going to run very large structural fiscal deficits kind of regardless of election outcomes, and that these changes kind of affect the direction or the, around the margins where those deficits go or how big they might be, but they don't really fundamentally change my thesis in any way. As far as Bitcoin's concerned, I've been in the camp writing that I think it's more likely to break up out of this consolidation that it's been in rather than break down. And, there's a number of reasons why. I think what happened was that the launch of the spot ETFs in the US earlier this year kind of pulled forward some demand. There was that period in the springtime where the price just went vertical and people got very euphoric. And I think it took time for the market to kind of digest that. Some of the initial euphoria wore off. We kind of went sideways. If you look at things like on-chain cost basis, like realized price, that was inching up the whole time during the entire consolidation, which is healthy. It basically means that more Bitcoin was trading hands at these higher price points and kind of setting a higher foundation. So I think that the breakout is healthy. I think I think it happened at the right time. I think this kind of resumes the bull market that we were in maybe before that we pulled forward some of that bull market. I don't ha like anyone else. I don't know if we're going to retest the breakout area or not. I don't really follow too much of the day-to-day price action, but I think it's a healthy bull market to kind of enter. And I'm generally bullish for the rest of this year and then kind of next year.
I don't know. Do you give out price targets?
Not generally. I released a report with Sam Callahan a little while ago that kind of analyzed that Bitcoin tracks with global liquidity indicators pretty well. It's among all assets that I cover, Bitcoin is the price is more correlated with these measures of global liquidity than any other asset that I track. So I generally have opinions around, say, 12 to 18 month price direction. There are sometimes I'm more cautious if we're looking at on-chain metrics that are pretty inflated, and then kind of like liquidity's rolling over, and like I tend to be more like trying to manage expectations around what's going to happen. Whereas other times I'm quite bullish, and I'm always kind of structurally long-term bullish as part of my thesis. So I tend to be on the bear side of bullish, which is that I don't really give out these really grandiose price targets because I'd rather be surprised at the upside then surprise to the downside. So in the last cycle, my first target was, I think we're going to hit $1 trillion in market cap. We did. That was something like, 50,000 a coin or a little over. Then my view was we're probably going to hit 100K and we didn't. And there were other people calling for, 200,000 or more. So even my relatively conservative target was a little bit too high. I think we're going to hit that this cycle, hopefully much higher, but I don't really give specific price targets because it's a fairly small asset class still, and relatively small amounts of global money coming into it can shift it pretty rapidly. So I tend to have more of an opinion around price and I mean more of an opinion around direction and maybe longer term where I think it could end up rather than, it's going to hit this price by this year. I don't really try to forecast that too much.
Is the role that Bitcoin plays in the global economy, is that like, does that change the price projection? So what I mean is, so far we've had it was like a collectible for nerds, so to say. I mean, this is I'm overdoing this right now, right? But then we enter the phase where we can it's now a legitimate asset to own as a hedge against debasement. Larry Fink is talking about that. Even JP Morgan is now calling for the debasement trade, which I think is hilarious. Because gold bugs have been talking about this for like 40 years, right? And then of course there is the question of Bitcoin as even a sovereign asset. I mean, there is talk about an American Bitcoin reserve, which I think is probably not around the corner, but at least there's talk about this, right? So do you have different scenarios?
There's certainly different scenarios. I mean, that's why I don't give price targets because if the United States just came out and said, "Hey, we're going to do a strategic reserve," then that's going to affect the price compared to that not happening or any other sizable country for that matter. Right now, we have rather small countries that use it in their sovereign reserve. So El Salvador, the Kingdom of Bhutan, any like any number of dozens of fairly large countries, if they were to come out and do this, they're less likely to do it. But if they were, that can, you know, kind of change price forecasts. I generally view more structurally that Bitcoin is kind of working its way up the monetization route. So it goes from collectible to kind of niche medium of exchange. Like, for example, when WikiLeaks lost all their payment rails back in like 2011, that was one of the first kind of tangible use cases of Bitcoin. I think it was 2010 actually, but basically it was like let's send Bitcoin if you want to donate rather than these other methods, because they were shut down and it became this like backup option. Then of course as it's limited by its supply cap, so it became more interesting to long-term holders and investors. And there's kind of a like liquidity limit. So when Bitcoin was fairly small, where a handful of people, you know, a handful of wealthy people, if they want to buy it, they end up moving the price. Mm-hmm. That there was liquidity limitations for what institutions could do with the asset. And so it kind of had to reach certain levels of adoption before it even gets on their radar in any serious way. And I think now we're entering that it's a large and liquid enough market that major institutions and then to some extent sovereigns can potentially view it as an asset that they could hold, or that is of relevance to them, good or bad. You know, there are some institutions that are like, you know, kind of worried about it, and there are others that are like, hey, maybe this is something we can invest in now. It can be useful for us. So I do think that it's reaching that level where it's more in the conversation now. Another thing that I kind of point out is that even though Bitcoin has had multiple cycles of highs, like higher highs and higher lows along the way, most people didn't see the early ones, and most people don't look at the logarithmic Bitcoin price chart. And so for a lot of people, Bitcoin always looks like it's in a bubble or it's a broken bubble. They kind of look at the linear price chart. They only see the last cycle or two. I think when they personally see three higher highs, they start to realize that this isn't going away. So the 2017 cycle was kind of the first like big public awareness cycle. Then the, you know, the 2020, 2021 was a second cycle that was pretty mass, known. And this is the third one. This is the, you know, a higher high since those kind of, it's the third kind of public cycle of getting higher highs. And I think that's relevant. I think when people see it firsthand that this is, you know, they keep ignoring it and it keeps going higher. I think people start to take it more seriously.
Going back to the idea of Bitcoin as a monetary technology, because I think this is the right viewpoint as well. If I wanted to explain this to my mom, right? Like, where do I start? Because it's rather easy to explain. Well, first we had the landline, then we had the dumb phone. Now we have the smartphone. People can kind of relate to this, even though it all went very quickly. Now we have AI. You know, everybody is completely convinced that AI is going to take over the world within like 2 weeks, right? But with like, when I go there and say, okay, maybe we should use a computer instead of central banks, and you know, people look at me like I'm crazy. And I think it's because you know, there is a lobby and there is vested interest into the system. So how far do you go back? Is it 400 years to like the founding of the Bank of Amsterdam, or what is it exactly where Bitcoin really innovates?
So I generally focus a lot on the past two centuries. From where I talk about it the most, I mean, broken money literally goes back thousands of years, because that's, you know, kind of goes back to our earliest technologies, our earliest ledger systems, the earliest things we used as money tens of thousands of years ago were money like things like shells that had more monetary premium in them than many other objects that people of that era used. So depending on the context, I'm happy to go really far back. One of the things I focus on in the recent time is the kind of the dawn of the telecommunications age. So once, prior to the invention of the telegraph, which was the 1830s, and then specifically like the laying of like long transcontinental telegraph cables in like the 1850s and 60s, before then, information could only move at the speed of matter, right? So if people wanted to, you know, at least a high bandwidth information, you could do fire signals in the night, but that's not very high bandwidth. So if any sort of like high bandwidth information, someone had to physically go there. Even if you're only keeping track of things on a ledger, it's moving around at the speed of paper, and people moving that paper around on foot, on horses, on ships. And the telegraph widened that. So now information could move around the world at the speed of light. Starting in the 1860s, and I mean, you didn't even get cross-Pacific cables until the early 1900s, and going from there. So really, only a little bit over a century where we've been in this telecommunication global era. And one of the things I point out in the book is that, this brought us a lot of wonderful things, but also gave us a mismatch. So now, information moved at the speed of light, but physical settlement of money was still slow. And if you can do information at the speed of light, it means you can do transactions at the speed of light, because a transaction can be as simple as an agreement to, I send you money, and I can go through these like legal channels over the speed of telecommunications. And the problem is that when you have transactions moving at the speed of light, but settlements still slow, one of the solutions for it is centralization. So even though there were central banks prior to that time, like you mentioned Amsterdam, of course, there was the Bank of England as well. The kind of the era of central banking took off because this was basically a time for them to say, well, like you have all these kind of things netting around. Let's all put it on our big ledger, which is that's what a central bank is. It's kind of the national ledger that underpins all the other central banks. They kind of pull it into this one big thing. Compared to a free banking arrangement where gold and silver is kind of the nature's ledger. So we solved these kind of mismatches through centralization. And so the way that I kind of describe Bitcoin is that technology's finally progressed enough where we now have very fast settlement in addition to transactions. So we've enjoyed fast transactions for a long time, but no way to finally settle value, like other than very slowly. And now we finally have the ability to do that within minutes, or in some cases seconds, depending on a higher layer of the technology. And so Bitcoin represents a way to run a ledger that has trust in it, that there's reasons to expect that its attributes to remain fairly consistent over time, despite the fact that there's no single entity running it. It's a way to coordinate multiple entities to settle value, to recognize a shared ledger. And I view it as kind of like we've kind of progressed past the point where centrally controlled ledgers are kind of the best way to solve something, and that now we have Bitcoin.
Do you think this is something that people in central banks will see and say at some point, say, well, jolly good then let's do this, because we are here to solve a problem, right? We're not here to or is the system, gone so far down the road of monetary debasement that it's not going to incorporate Bitcoin, it's just gonna try and fight Bitcoin the way maybe Jeff Booth says is going to happen.
So governments and central banks are not a monolith. They consist of multiple people. And so I think that while there will be individuals in governments and central banks that are interested in the technology, that most will not be. Because few people ever want to give up their own power, right? I mean, for a long time, the central bank's position is basically trust us. Like we're the ones running the ledger. You can trust us. The trust is often broken. And now there's technology and other ways of that people can choose to trust instead, and that they have more self-verification over and more self-autonomy over. And government right now around the world is kind of based on the idea that if they run deficits or their bond market has a problem, well, they have a central bank that can just kind of print more units and fix the problem. And kind of spread that debasement out more invisibly among people that hold their money. And that's not something that I think entities are quick to let loose, that they're more likely to fight to retain it. Even though there are individuals, usually minority voices within governments that come out and say, I think this is good. I think we should, so there are people in government that are saying, let's go back on a gold standard or let's embrace Bitcoin. But those tend to be, the non-majority view in a lot of cases. And I think that's probably going to continue for a while. And I also think that even as countries embrace Bitcoin in some ways, like, for example, a sovereign reserve or something, I've generally been of the view that governments are going to be anti-privacy for quite a while. Because ever since the modern era, They shifted a lot toward income taxes. That kind of requires surveillance to make sense. So back in the older days before income taxes, there were different types of taxes because you like even if you were a king and you had all sorts of grandiose views of what you should control, you wouldn't even think that you could monitor everyone's income and take a certain percentage. Like it's just too many transactions were inherently private for that to be a workable thing. And so taxes were done in other ways. But in the modern era where everybody has a bank account, and it's all kind of centralized and surveilled, we shifted more toward income taxes, and private transactions kind of bring us back to like a faster version of an earlier age. And I think that's where they're going to keep pushing back on because I think they're going to say, well, okay, you can hold Bitcoin, but we'd prefer to be in these walled gardens that we can see. And I think that's that they're going to probably be enemies of financial privacy for quite a while.
This is a very, very important point, a very interesting point. So way I see it, and this is very simplified, is there is the technology of centralization and running a central ledger because it is actually advantageous to having chaos, basically. And then there is the side effect that at some point these entities become so powerful that they can manipulate the monetary base and the monetary supply basically in a way they want to, and then the powerful can use them. And one of the side effects is what we call the Cantillon effect, and I think the chapter that you have in your book about the Cantillon effect, I enjoyed it very much because you actually turned your method around and you didn't start with Richard Cantillon in the 17 or 1600s, but you started with the crisis that we all know, like the financial crisis and then the COVID crisis, and the rich getting richer, having access to fresh money, and the income tax is actually a big problem there, right? Because people from at a certain level of like a certain level of wealth, they don't need an income anymore. They can use credit and other ways of cash flow and to get money, and they don't actually pay any income tax, while the small people still have to work and pay income tax.
Yeah, exactly. The closer that you are to the source of money creation, either because you're able to borrow at the lowest rates or because you're able to get bailouts and things like that, that's such a big structural boost. And when it comes to central banking, I mean, I've been in the camp that I prefer free banking. But one of the arguments I make in the book is that it's not an accident that we don't really see that anywhere in the world. When the entire world goes one direction for a period of time, there's generally something more fundamental behind it. Kind of technology enables something to happen, and then people in power seized it everywhere. There's not like any exceptions really. But one of the things I point out is that because of Bitcoin, we finally have technology to roll a lot of that back. So most financial innovations over centuries were centralizing in some way. So we're exchanging gold and silver, and then we put the emperor's face on it to help standardize it. And then, we want to transport gold between different cities and different regions without, the security of potentially losing it. So then we build like paper IOUs on top of it. And even the invention of paper itself was a monetary technology at the end of the day. It helped kind of change how people in practice use money. And then the invention of the printing press further changed what you can do with paper, economically. It kind of opened up. It kind of redu you could say it reduced the cost of analog encryption, because it's kind of like you can mass produce verifiable things now, more than you could back when you had to physically handwrite each one, and that's kind of over time money got more and more centralized. It kind of shifted more toward banks, and then it shifted more toward central banks. Like I mentioned, the telegraph and the telephone and the internet, all this as we entered the digital era, almost every friction in finance was solved by, well, let's have another layer of centralization. So it's like if I want to transact with you, we could, and this is like Venice from centuries ago, we would just say, okay, well, here's our third party, that's a banker, and they're going to make our transactions with each other easier because we're both going to trust this person. And then if there's another person at a different bank that we want to transact with, well, those two bankers get together and say, well, let's have this like settlement structure between ourselves. And then if there's like as the world opened up and as entities in different countries are communicating with each other, then they need like a third layer to say, well, how can our like settlement bank settle with your settlement bank? And then it just became every friction was, well, let's add another layer of like, bigger centralization under it. And the problem is we kind of reached the end of the road there. Now we have very significant centralization. And the downsides of that centralization, the centralized nature of control, the centralized nature of breaking trust, in terms of, say, sound money, for example. And with Bitcoin, we have the technology to do it in a more decentralized way again, in the modern era.
There is Keynes gets a bad rap in circles of sound money advocates and Austrian economics, and much of that is probably deserved. I found a fascinating quote by him in the book Lords of Finance. You've probably read it, about the time after the World War I, and from the perspective of central bankers, when gold was still orthodox, right? The gold standard was still an orthodox idea. And Keynes said, well, the problem with the gold is that we took the gold, we put it into cellars and into basements and into safes, and now we don't actually have gold anymore. We use the idea of gold, right? And the government represents this idea of gold with its paper money. And the same thing could potentially be happening with Bitcoin. Is there a danger there? Because we see BlackRock, and we might even see governments getting into the Bitcoin game. So is Bitcoin the technology strong enough to stay decentralized enough for us to enjoy its benefits?
So my view is that it is strong enough, but that is something to monitor the trends of how that goes. So the main difference in this case between Bitcoin and gold is, in addition to being scarcer, basically a long run in debasement rate of zero, it's easier to send and settle. When Germany repatriated its gold from the U.S., that was a multi-year process, and it cost millions of dollars to repatriate billions of dollars or euros worth of gold. And it's funny, they finished ahead of schedule, but ahead of schedule still took years just because of the logistics of securely doing that, all the administrative overhead. It's kind of unbelievable to me that it took years. I don't know if that's our side, or I don't know what the specifics were for why that took so long. But basically, sending gold over long distances is inherently a slow, expensive process to do securely. And Bitcoin can do it in 10 minutes or half an hour or an hour, depending on how many blocks you want your transaction to settle under, the size of it, and what level of verification you need. And that is a multi-order of magnitude improvement over gold. There are still some scaling questions associated with it. And the way that I generally phrase it is that Bitcoin doesn't replace all banks per se. It's not as though every single person is likely going to be like this fully self-autonomous, entity, but it gives a lot of people the optionality to be if they want to be, and it's this decentralized settlement network that's kind of like Fedwire. So in the United States, we have Fedwire. It's our federal reserve settlement system, our biggest one between banks. And this it's it sounds like a funny number, but they settle $1 quadrillion worth of value per year, so 1,000 trillions worth of gross settlement volume per year. A lot of that is for the rest of the world too, because all these a lot of international contracts occur in dollars, so that's settling for the U.S. It's also settling indirectly for entities around the world. And the funny thing is, they do it with about as many transactions per second as the Bitcoin network. So they do something like 200,000, 200 million transactions per year at around $5 million for the average transaction size, and that's how they get a quadrillion dollars worth of settlement. And the way that I generally view it is that Bitcoin is now a global decentralized version of that, and that we have to build layers on top of it. To the extent that people want to trustlessly send value quicker and cheaper with each other. And then for some people, using banks or third parties could be helpful. Maybe it's solving a problem for them. But it would be concerning if too much of it was in the hands of very few. If it all kind of gravitated toward BlackRock, that obviously wouldn't be great. Right now, the statistics of the network show that it's still pretty dispersed among whales, among kind of large entities around the world that invested pretty early. And to the extent that more of it gets sucked into, BlackRock and their custodians, or MicroStrategy and their custodians, that bids the price up pretty significantly, which then reduces their ability to keep acquiring more. So I'm pretty optimistic about its level of decentralization, but I don't think people should, rest on their laurels. I think it's a risk worth monitoring. And that's part of the reason I'm involved in the Bitcoin venture space. So, I mean, I'm a general partner at Ego Death Capital, and we invest in companies that are, trying to make Bitcoin faster, more private, that are providing things, whether it's Lightning technology, whether it's Trellmian eCash, whether it's other solutions to help Bitcoin move around in a as decentralized and secure way as possible.
Because if it isn't, right? If it isn't, then at some point, if like 95% of all Bitcoin are just in like ETFs or in central bank accounts, then it actually is just an instrument of speculation. Then it is not used in the real world anymore. And there is a huge potential for Bitcoin to be used on an everyday basis if we build the technology.
I think, yeah, I agree, but I think the difference is that the so back like say a century ago, when people were comparing gold versus banks, people they shifted entirely to banks. They put all their gold in the bank and were fine to just like trust the bank and trust the central bank. And there really wasn't an alternative. So even when banks broke trust, like if you look around the world today, when emerging market currencies fail, they don't fall back to gold, they fall back to the dollar. Ironically, and it's basically because they need that speed. They need to be able to send value around quickly. So there wasn't really an alternative. That's kind of why those trusted parties gained so much power, is that people voluntarily used their services, and even when they broke that trust, the fallback options were so slow. And the cool thing about Bitcoin is that while an on-chain transaction might be clunkier than kind of our fastest fiat methods, some of the higher layers on Bitcoin are competitive with the fastest methods on fiat. And when trust gets broken in the fiat system, you can fall back and use Bitcoin and its various kind of layered stack pretty effectively compared to what you could do with gold and silver. In any time in the modern era, at this in a communication connected world, where we buy online, where we need transactions to move quickly, Bitcoin is this kind of constant available fallback that people can turn to. So, and I think that it's mostly going to be enforced by the highly engaged minority, right? So, if there's a fairly significant number of people, but that are still a minority of the population that understand what's going on with debasement, that understand how Bitcoin works, and that hold a pretty big chunk of Bitcoin, because wealth kind of tends to concentrate to some degree just because of how things work. As long as there's a certain level of interest there, I think it's this really powerful thing that's going to, persist for the foreseeable future.
Is it understandable to concentrate on the store of value function first in order to monetize Bitcoin? Because yes, we can use it as a money today, but what we actually see is that USD Tether and other stable coins are now being used in like places like Turkey or South America, which if you look at it does make sense. Now, I did, because you mentioned Bhutan, so I had the chance to go there a couple of months ago, and we even talked to the king. And they are is super serious. I mean, I would say they are more serious about Bitcoin than El Salvador is, right? And I had like the central bank, like a very high up at the central bank, coming up to me and saying, "Well, what do you think the role of central banks is in the Bitcoin world?" It was completely bizarre from our point of view, but it was also beautiful. And for them, of course, holding Tether is not really an option because they either want Bitcoin or like the real currency thing, right? Like on a sovereign level, you don't want to do that. But if you're a small person, you can do Tether for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think that stable coins, that's the other technology that I think is relevant in the space. So Bitcoin and stable coins. Stable coins solve a different problem, like you mentioned, it's working capital. It's short term, less volatile holdings, usually pretty efficient because they're on more centralized blockchains. They can move around pretty efficiently and at pretty high scale, because the underlying asset's centralized anyway, so people are less picky about what blockchain it's transferring across. I do think that for the most part, at scale, store of value precedes medium of exchange. So more people have a savings problem than a payments problem, especially in the developed world. So especially in the United States and Europe, we have more of a savings problem than a payments problem. I wake up every day thinking, what can I store value in so that I still have value 10 years from now? I
Is
don't wake up.
that really the first thing that you think about in the morning?
Well, I was going to compare that to the alternative. Like I don't wake up and say, I wish my payment methods were more efficient.
Oh yeah, okay.
I could pay for Starbucks easier than I currently can, right? So between the two, there's one I think about and there's one that I rarely think about. And that's true for a lot of people. And because Bitcoin's volatile, it's emerging into, it's got some sort of total addressable market. As generally Bitcoin bulls, we have ideas of where that total addressable market might be, pretty bigger compared to where it is now. Basically, the value for good money is quite large. But it has time to, one, be tested, be understood, be educated about, and gradually kind of grow its network effect and liquidity and reach that total addressable market. So while it's going through that process, it's more prone to booms and busts along the way, which can interfere with its medium of exchange usage or unit of account usage. That doesn't mean, though, that medium of exchange entirely happens later. Part of it happens in parallel, generally on a more niche level. So, for example, one of the first things Bitcoin was ever used for, WikiLeaks, preceded most of the store of value aspect. It didn't really even have like a marketable price then. But
Interesting.
so it's like entities that need that capability generally gravitate toward it earlier. And in Africa, there's 40 different currencies. There's over 40 currencies in Africa. There's over 30 currencies in Latin America. Anyone who moves money around internationally, like it kind of goes against my prior point of not waking up and saying I have a payments problem. Well, anyone who does a lot of international payments, they wake up and say I have a payments problem. Or anyone who's running a pretty large business with low margins, and they can look and see how much credit card margins are interfering with them. There are some of those types of entities that do wake up and say these payment problems are either inefficient or expensive, and Bitcoin can help with that. So I think in general that at scale, store of value precedes medium of exchange, but the medium of exchange happens in parallel in niche cases, and part of that is what gives the store of value its ability anyway. Like if the only thing I could do with Bitcoin is go to Coinbase and exchange it for fiat, then it wouldn't be very valuable to me. It'd be this like centralized thing. The fact that I have the optionality that I could pay for goods and services in many urban centers around the world or online is part of what gives the store of value its capability in the first place, even if I'm not doing a lot of volume with that.
And it would mean, and this is something I do think about a lot, it would mean that we have a chance for like putting many billions of people who now are living in systems that are even brokener than ours, if that's even a word, right? We can put them on a hard money standard and they could, get to work and actually get actual money for their work and then transact that money. And basically what we're talking about here is a completely new economic paradigm that the world has never literally never seen before.
Yeah, and I spend part of each year in Egypt because I have family and friends there. In fact, I'll be there in a week again. And the debasement rate there, I mean, the money supply grows at over 20% per year on average. So in the United States, it's averaged about 7% money supply growth. Obviously, the COVID era was a spike there. There are other periods that were a little slower, but about 7% per year. The numbers are often pretty similar in other developed countries, so much of Europe. Whereas in emerging markets, developing countries, it's faster. And in Egypt's case, it's over 20%. I know physicians, they work 6 days a week in a hospital, and then they get paid in Egyptian pounds that are constantly debasing. So then they literally go to the black market and buy physical dollars and store them in their apartment in the year 2024. Or they buy extra real estate as illiquid savings. So you have a situation where a lot of homes are just built and empty because people are like, I'd rather store value in that than the local currency. Gold's also popular. When you look at the generally the lower income spectrum there, they're often saving in local physical cash, like Egyptian pounds, And so they're just getting debased at 20% a year with no interest to even soften the blow. So the wealthier ones that are storing cash, at least they're getting some interest. This is kind of the classic Kantian effect. So when you're at the lower end there, you're literally holding cash, you're often unbanked, and you're just getting rug pulled like month after month after month. And I think that, yeah, this is a long-term solution that can help that, because that's one of the things emphasized in the book, that there are, there's almost 200 countries in the world, many of which have their own currencies. Even the pegged currencies sometimes break their pegs. And there's a variety of different debasement rates happening around the world that are subject, billions of people are negatively impacted by them. And so there's obviously a really big problem set here to address with better money where we can.
But do your friends in Egypt, do they get Bitcoin? I mean, do they save in Bitcoin now because you told them about it or because they found out about it? Because the examples that you gave were not Bitcoin related.
So for the most part, no. And this is one thing I found interesting is that, for example, I mean the two most populated two of the most populated countries in Africa are Nigeria and Egypt. And Nigeria is way ahead in terms of Bitcoin and stablecoin adoption
True.
compared to Egypt. Egypt has been slow, both even in stablecoins, but also Bitcoin. And I think part of that was because Egypt, so they tend to peg their currency for s longer periods of time, and they kind of create the sense that it's pretty stable. And then usually there's one big devaluation all at once, and then people go back to thinking, okay, we're stable again. And then it, 3 years later, it devalues again.
That just happened a couple of months ago, right?
Yeah,
In Egypt.
they went through another series of devaluations, and people there. The three main answers to debasement are dollars, gold, and real estate is how most people view it. Obviously, there are niche pockets of people that understand Bitcoin, and we've done our best to educate our friends and family about it. But yeah, broadly speaking, it's not a very active market for Bitcoin, at least on a per capita basis.
Because I think it's a quote from Saylor who says that Bitcoin is there when you need it and you see it when you need it. And it does make like there is a poetic justice to this, right? That countries that don't have their own currency, so El Salvador has a dollar, so they're not losing anything if they introduce Bitcoin. Bhutan is using their own currency, but it's pegged to the Indian rupee, so they don't really have any power within their central bank. So it makes sense. It makes sense for us as individuals. It doesn't matter if we are in the West or in any developing country. So my question, and we're already coming to the end, but your book is called Broken Money, and there's this meme in Bitcoin, fix the money, fix the world, right? And now we're getting to this point where people are discussing this national Bitcoin reserve, and we even have Trump like literally sitting on television saying that maybe I'm not trying his voice now, right? Maybe we'll pay give them some Bitcoin, right? Like pay off the debt in Bitcoin. So there's like this signaling that we could use a hard asset to extinguish the debt, so to say. We have the same thing in Europe actually from the central bank. So the central bank of the Netherlands, they would regularly say, well, that the debt doesn't is not important because we still have the gold. We just let the gold run up and it's all fine. So there is some recognition that hard assets can help here. But could you explain how exactly that would work? Because I don't think it's easy to understand.
Yeah, I think it's a longer term process. I think we're ever since the global financial crisis, we're kind of shifting around the margins toward a kind of a high level awareness of harder money. So, if you look at central banks' holdings of gold, they were declining for decades in tonnage until 2009, and then they started going up again. In 2013, China stopped accumulating treasuries. They even publicly said it's no longer in our best interest to keep putting our surplus savings into treasuries. They started doing their Belt and Road Initiative, so lending to, commodity deposits or infrastructure. It's kind of their version of getting a little harder than just holding treasuries. We started to see a shift toward more and more central banks repatriating their gold, whether it's Germany, whether it's India, a number of central banks kind of just pulling gold back. During the recent era of more rapid money printing, we saw an uptick in central bank gold buying. And of course, as Bitcoin's grown to now being a well over $1 trillion, trillion euro asset, it's starting to enter the discussion at fairly high levels. Obviously, among individuals, it's been in the discussion for quite a while, but now that it's big and liquid, institutions and sovereigns can start talking about it. I think talk precedes action. So, like you mentioned, the small countries where there's like a key decision maker, and they don't really have a powerful central bank anyway. It's easier to make the call to, get involved with Bitcoin. Bigger ones with more vested interest and more moving parts for decisions are tend they're going to be slower to get into it. And the way that I kind of see this playing out longer term, at least as of where I sit now, is that when you look at emerging markets, they constantly face the threat of the dollar. So, to the extent that they mismanage their money too rapidly, more and more people will try to get dollars. And like we mentioned, stablecoins, that's another avenue that people have to get dollars now, but people were already doing that to begin with. So whether it's physically, whether it's through stablecoins, the more that a country mismanages its currency, the faster people wake up and want to get things like dollars or other things. And Bitcoin is kind of like that for developed market currencies. So the now that it exists and it's big enough and liquid enough, it can start long term pressuring the dollar, the euro, and the yen in a similar way that the dollar and to some extent the euro have always pressured these smaller ones. It's kind of like the apex predator of money, and not even by being an offensive way. It's just always there as an option. So it's like a good apex predator. It's like this benevolent, passive, peaceful apex predator that exists. And I think that's kind of the long-term trend here is that more and more things keep breaking. And instead of multiple things always gravitating toward the dollar, now we have alternatives. So we see central banks gravitating toward gold again, kind of waking up from their multi-decade love for treasuries. And as Bitcoin gets bigger, I think that increasingly also becomes relevant and arguably better.
But there is this still this chasm that we have to cross if we want central banks to get into Bitcoin, right? Because central banks have been holding gold forever. I was in the here in Austria. We also repatriated our gold when Germany did it, because basically the Austrian central bank just looks at what the German central bank does and then does the same thing. That's basically the strategy for decades now. And they showed us the gold. I was in the gold vaults, I think, two or three times, right? But nobody could ever actually explain why they did it. Officially, there was no real reason, and unofficially, there were a couple of statements, but nothing really that I could believe as somebody who's into that stuff, right? I just think that they're realizing that we don't need it in any foreign place of trade anymore. We can bring it back at least half because the price is going up anyway. So we can this, when this goes down to the question, who even owns the gold? Is it part of the euro system? It's on the balance sheet, but when things come to shove, will Austria, will Germany really give that gold to the euro, or will they just keep it for themselves, right? So there is that, but I see BlackRock. Maybe I'll form it as a question, of course. Is BlackRock a form of if you cannot beat them, join them?
I think so. Yeah, I think that they realize it's a market in Bitcoin and that they can either watch it or they can get fees from it is kind of how they view it. And the gold repatriation is interesting because the reason why it's kind of so centralized anyway is two main reasons. One is that going back to the prior point around gold being slow. It's way easier for entities to all put their gold in one spot so that with one phone call, they can just, move gold from one vault to another vault in the same building. So one is the inefficiency of gold. And two is that during World War II and then in the kind of the earlier Cold War, countries were worried about being invaded. So a lot of them would shift their gold toward, places like New York for safekeeping. And now, as the U.S. is less of a uni power over the world than it was at the end of World War II, we're entering a more multipolar type of world. The global GDP is more spread out. The U.S. used to be over 40% of global GDP. Now it's down to the 20s. And so I think that repatriation is natural. It creates a more decentralized world. I think more and more entities will probably come along and say, if you can't beat them, join them. So whether that's major institutions like BlackRock, whether it's countries, and I think that happens as, when Bitcoin's only $100 billion market and it's not very liquid, it's not really, no one's really going to at that level jump into it. But when it's a multi-trillion-dollar, trillion-euro asset, as it's kind of entering that phase now, and it's been there for a few years off and on, that starts to become relevant for that scale. And I know in BlackRock's case, I mean, their head of digital assets has worked there for years. I know him to some extent, and he's been trying to orange pill BlackRock for a while. And it's like over time, he's been able to help educate the rest of the company around the asset. And I think that happens in a lot of institutions. And I talk to a lot of people at these institutions. There's like vice presidents or boards of directors, people high up in various organizations, whether it's government, whether it's corporate, whether it's foundations. There are like pro Bitcoin people, but they're the minority voice. And over time, as Bitcoin gets larger and more successful, and the number of those people grow, some of them are able to flip their organization to being pro Bitcoin. And it can seem sudden on the surface, but it generally started out by, a minority entity in that organization slowly trying to say, hey, maybe for the health of our organization, we should take this asset seriously.
But it is also really absurd, right? I mean, I met Larry Fink in 2018. I did an interview for my old newspaper when he came to Vienna. I asked him about Bitcoin. He said, "No, it's fraud. It's money laundering. It will go away. It will go to zero." That's his quote, right? And of course, you can change your mind. But then having the man, like the head of the biggest asset manager in the world sitting on CNBC, not saying like, yeah, people like Bitcoin, it's like digital beanie babies, you can buy it if you want, you don't, like, he could do that, right? No, he's sitting there and saying, no, you can, it transcends currencies, if you're afraid that your country will debase the currency, wink wink, because all of them are, then you can get Bitcoin. So he really gets like the core of it now.
Yeah, and I think that's a big shift. And I think that part of that goes back to the prior point of if you see it making higher highs multiple times, you start to realize that this isn't, tulips. So when people first see a bubble, they think it's tulips. The second bubble, they're like, well, that was just liquidity because of COVID. People can find narratives to dismiss it. But when they see it come back multiple times, they're more likely to be like, you know what? I'm actually going to take this asset seriously now. Some people do change their minds. Some people, they finally listen to their friends and colleagues, and realize maybe I'm thinking about this wrong. And then they read about it or they otherwise educate themselves about it. And then to varying degrees, they say, more structurally, this asset's real. It's the best at what it does. And what it does is valuable in a world of centralized money and debasing money, and now you have decentralized and non-debasing money, and I think more and more entities are waking up to that.
Okay, Lynn, thank you very much. One last like big topic, because we have been talking about how Bhutan and El Salvador and maybe Egypt, and individual persons get into Bitcoin. But now you have Trump and you have his speech at the Bitcoin conference in Nashville, and you have did you see the interview that Howard Lutkin, I think that's his name, right, gave to Pomp about Bitcoin? It was amazing.
Yeah, I didn't watch that, but I know of it, and I know that he spoke at the Bitcoin conference as well. For people that don't know, that's a prime dealer for U.S. Treasuries that is like endorsing Bitcoin. And so it is reaching kind of the highest levels of power. Trump has talked about, maybe not selling the Bitcoin that the US already has. He's talked about maybe kind of reducing or eliminating capital gains taxes on it, which can help monetize it. I generally, I because there's a lot of moving parts here, I generally take the under on when that'll happen or what magnitude that'll happen. But the fact that it's even being discussed is relevant. And that's part of Bitcoin's evolution. The monetization over time is that, years ago it was, smaller entities, wealthy individuals saying, "Hey, is this an asset I should hold?" And that's kind of the discussion that it was on. And now that it's gotten bigger, now the BlackRocks and the sovereigns of the world are writing papers on it and saying, "Is this something we should be involved in?" In Trump's prior term, he was pretty anti-Bitcoin. He's got a number of
Very.
statements on the record. They're not positive toward it. The Treasury under his term was very kind of anti-privacy. And it was just not a very strong term for Bitcoin. But I think, again, if you can't beat them, join them. I mean, that's in the United States, the amount of lobbying dollars from Bitcoin-related entities or more broadly crypto-related entities was massive compared to like other lobbying. And it just basically waked up that you a politician in the US at least gains little from being against Bitcoin, and can gain a lot for being for it. And this particular election, I mean, there are a number of anti-Bitcoin people that like lost their seats in Congress. And some of these like lobbying groups literally snipe them. They literally will try to, they're saying, "Look, we don't care what party you are, as long as you're not like anti-Bitcoin. And if you're anti-Bitcoin, we're going to fund your opponent." And that's a trend that's real. And government's not a monolith. So I think more and more entities in government, whether it's the U.S. or elsewhere, start to appreciate it. And it's better to be early on that trend than be late. If you're like last country to get it, you lose out. Whereas if you're one of the early countries to get it, like Bhutan or El Salvador, you benefit disproportionately.
But that's why I'm so like flabbergasted. We're jumping from Bhutan to from El Salvador to Bhutan, and then we're not jumping to like Turkey. We're jumping to the United States of America, and that's weird. That should not be like it makes sense, of course, from the perspective of the biggest capital markets and the best understanding of money. And of course, what Trump said about the energy, I think, is even more relevant, because he said we're going to have the cheapest energy in the world. I mean, that is a big statement, right? And you cannot do this, probably cannot do this without Bitcoin miners. But still, I have to say, I have a hard time believing that this is really happening still.
I agree with you that in the sense that I'm surprised that we've not seen more small to mid-level sized countries get involved, right? So like I do think it's weird to go from like the smallest to like the biggest. Now I would say at this phase we're in the talking about it phase. We're not actively building a sovereign wealth fund with Bitcoin. We haven't made it. We haven't taken away the capital gains taxes yet. These are ideas that are being discussed. So we'll see to what extent we act in a tangible sense get on the Bitcoin train. Obviously, some of our institutions have, but whether the government will at size remains unclear. Merely getting out of its way is helpful. So basically saying, "Hey, if you want to mine Bitcoin, you can mine Bitcoin, make our energy cheaper." That's already relevant. And gaining benefits for people. But yeah, I do think that it's somewhat surprising that we haven't seen a number of other smaller or mid-sized countries get it because they can disproportionately benefit from it when they get it. And it's the same thing for corporations. Like, why haven't more corporations done what MicroStrategy is doing? And it's I think a lot of entities are kind of asleep at the wheel.
Is it really like maybe is it really like the question of like do you need persons at the right moment in time who actually like the former CEO of Sotheby's said the other day on Twitter, right? Who put in the time to work for 100 hours, 1,000 hours, read books like yours, Broken Money, and then can actually argue for this extremely new thing, because we know from Bhutan, we know that the king. It's a kingdom, and the king knows about Bitcoin. He knows all about Bitcoin, and we know that Bukele knows about Bitcoin because Jack Ma has told him. And now we know that Trump knows about Bitcoin because he has Lutkin and he has David Bailey and he has all these people, right? So is it, and of course you told us about the guy from BlackRock. So is it really that simple? Is it just that there is not enough people knowing about Bitcoin at the right places?
Yeah, I think so. I think it trickles up to the decision makers at different speeds, and some of it's just, what is that organization like, and how does information move, and how adamant are some of the people there to spread it. Another example is Fidelity. That's a case. It's a very yes. large institution, and it happened to be that the CEO, she understood it pretty early on and was interested in it, like literally a decade ago. So Fidelity was like dabbling in like mining. They were producing some of the first analysts and like hiring some of the first Bitcoin analysts among major firms. And whereas other ones, usually it's like a vice president or like some sort of like, you know, like upper management is a Bitcoiner, and it's his or her job to try to convince the president or the CEO, whatever the case may be. In that case, it happened to be the leader of the organization. Same thing for MicroStrategy. That was, you know, Michael Saylor decided, you know, he reassessed everything, came across Bitcoin, and then he held a lot of his company in terms of, you know, voting rights. And so he was able to make a pretty decisive decision with his board of directors and his management rather quickly. And you know, like, you know, BlackRock gets it before Vanguard. And that's, you know, part of that's it could be cultural. It could be luck. You know, and Bhutan gets it before country XYZ, you know, and so some of it's just things don't happen at the same speed everywhere. But for those people that are listening to this, take 100 hours to study it, especially mm-hmm. if you're in any sort of decision-making capacity for your organization, because it's not an accident that MicroStrategy is like the best performing stock in the last 4 years. They're one of the only stocks that have like kept up with NVIDIA in terms of performance. And it's merely because they decided to shift to a Bitcoin standard. El Salvador is doing very strong relative to its peers right now. There's obviously a number of moving parts there, but the Bitcoin's not hurting. And if anything, I mean, they've boosted their tourism numbers. You know, the number of Americans and other people, Europeans traveling to El Salvador has increased because it's like the Bitcoin is around the world. Go there. And they basically also say, hey, if you want to have a business, we're open to that. And so I think that there's a lot of disproportionate benefits from understanding it and then acting decisively. And it hasn't happened at the same speed everywhere.
It must be the people, right? You're totally right about Fidelity and BlackRock. And I mean, this is of course alternative history, but if Jack Bogle was our age, he would be all over Bitcoin. I'm 100% sure the founder of Vanguard, right? And his Bogle heads, the people who buy Vanguard index funds, the only reliable source, like if there is a crash, they always buy more, right? Just like Bitcoiners, like hodlers. So what do you think, Lynn? Like, I know this is a stupid question, but what do you think we're going to see for 2025?
Probably higher prices. I mentioned before that Bitcoin tends to be pretty correlated with global liquidity. I expect probably global liquidity and Bitcoin price to go up in 2025. You know, to your prior point around Vanguard, that's where like an organization or a country's culture matters, because Vanguard has long had kind of an anti-gold and anti-commodity mm-hmm. stance. They've had the view that you should own income-producing assets like stocks and bonds. You know, to some extent, that's serving their own book. But they've had that view more than other asset managers. So, for example, BlackRock has had, you know, a gold ETF. You know, they don't really have that view the way that Vanguard had. And I think what we see in 2025 and thereafter is that if you have views like that, there's consequences for it. And so it pays to be nimble, to be able to reassess your thinking. And go from saying, look, maybe 5 years ago I was against Bitcoin, but I've learned more about it, and now I'm for it, and now we're going to do something about it. So I think we'll probably see gradually more and more entities make those types of decisions, and then they get rewarded for that. You know, assuming that we're all correct about the Bitcoin bull thesis long term, they get rewarded for that by being open and changing their mind.
But do you truly believe that by Bitcoin just existing, it basically changes the world, right? Like it changes the incentive structure for everyone in the long term.
Yeah, because I think it gives us a new option that exists now. So as long as the technology is sound enough that it doesn't get fully captured and centralized in some sort of way that impairs it, So it's kind of like with that caveat that as long as it continues to exist in the capacity that we understand it to, and I believe that it will, but of course that's a risk or an investigation that people have to do on their own. But as long as this technology and this network effect exists, it's this constant option that people have now, and the institutions have now, and the countries have now. And the larger it gets, the more like realistic that option is, because that diffuses the volatility, it increases the liquidity. Back when it was small, you couldn't buy $1 billion worth of Bitcoin or sell $1 billion worth of Bitcoin. It just wasn't even an option. And now you can. And eventually that could be, you could buy $1 trillion or sell $1 trillion. We're not there yet, but maybe eventually we will. And it can't even be useful at that level until it reaches that level of liquidity from the levels below it. And I think it's walking up those scales. And so it's becoming an option for more and more sizable entities, not just individuals, not just organizations, but now even some countries. And by existing, it can change things because it's a new way of thinking, but it's also literally an operating software network that people can gravitate toward. And one thing I've kind of emphasized is that protocols tend to be very long lasting once they achieve dominance. So whether it's TCP/IP, whether it's Ethernet, whether it's simple mail transfer protocol, whether it's USB, generally when something becomes ubiquitous, or at least like it dominates its category, they tend to have very long lifetimes, and they can update in backward compatible ways to stay relevant with technology. So Ethernet gets faster, but it's still Ethernet. USB gets faster, but it's still USB. And I think Bitcoin is now, we have this monetary protocol that has achieved network effect dominance, and exists now. And that alters the world just like some of these other protocols did.
And also, if the US really does this, if the US really gets the miners in, does a stockpile, runs a very Bitcoin friendly policy, it really like forces other countries, including China and hopefully Europe, to actually follow suit, because otherwise they would be at a huge disadvantage.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think all else being equal, it's better for smaller entities to get it first, because that can kind of diffuse power to some extent. If the United States gets it pretty early, that's not good for a lot of like mid-sized or other large entities, because is that the power gap then just increases more. So that's why decisions matter.
Decisions matter. Lynn, I guarantee you, I know that there is people like politicians, decision makers, and even members of government from Germany, Austria, and Switzerland listening to my podcast. So I hope that this has resonated with some of them. Please tell us, where do we find your newsletter? Where do we find your all your social media accounts?
So I'm at lynalden.com. I'm active on Twitter at lynaldencontact. For Bitcoiners that are on Noster, I'm available there as well. And Broken Money is available. And like we talked about before, it's being translated into German, and will be out shortly.
Broken Money, warum unser Finanzsystem uns im Stich lässt und wie wir es verbessern können. It will come out on the 6th of December 2024, which is actually my namesake day. I don't know how you say this in English. It's Saint Nicholas. So there's like a present for me there. If you buy it on Amazon, please pre-order it so we can make it a Spiegel bestseller. If you buy more than 10, you can get a premium subscriptions to Lynn's awesome newsletter. Lynn, thank you so much for taking the time. Please stay online until it's uploaded after we finish this, and we can talk about how we can get you to Germany and to Austria to explain this to people.
Great, awesome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.